I'm obviously attracted to the concept of simple living and a stoic aesthetic and something that is boiled down to the really fundamental things in life that matter. And you don't necessarily need cars and mansions and consumerism to do any of those things.
Hey, it's Nono, and this is the Getting Simple Podcast. Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that you can find a detailed list of episode notes, transcripts, and past episodes at gettingsimple.com, and that you can listen to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and Overcast. I'm also starting to upload learning videos to YouTube to teach the way in which I do things, and we'll start live streaming in the near future, covering topics from computational design and creative coding to design automation, machine learning, workflow optimization, or even how I make this podcast. You can find these videos if you go to gettingsimple.com/YouTube and look for my learning playlist. Hi everyone, it's Nono here. We have JR with us today from Insisting Simplicity. Hi JR, how are you doing today?
I am great. How are you?
I'm good. I am here in Spain recording remotely with JR. JR writes Insisting Simplicity, a blog about simple living, minimalism, and adventure travel that you can find if you go to insistingsimplicity.com. As stated in his site, he built Insisting Simplicity to celebrate life, our planet, and highlight the richness of simple living. Today, I'm expecting to learn more about your work and about things that range from permaculture to financial independence and many other topics that I've enjoyed looking at on your blog. The first thing is to thank you. So thanks so much for being here with us, JR. And I'd love to...
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I mean, thanks. This is an awesome opportunity for us to connect. I'd love for you to start by telling us a bit about yourself and how you got to where you are today.
Sure. Big question, so I'll give the shorter version. I grew up in rural Massachusetts. Flash forward to more professional career. For the majority of my career, I've been in the financial sector and most recently in private wealth management. We connected a week after I voluntarily resigned from my most recent firm, right before the coronavirus hit the United States. So some interesting timing. But that is the very shortest version, and we can kind of dig in wherever we want.
Yeah, sounds good. I would like to follow up with hearing what is the context in which you decide to start this blog and write it, and also why.
It's a silly reason, I guess. I was commuting. And I had a lot of windshield time, as they call it. So I really got into podcasts and self-improvement type of things. Tim Ferriss obviously comes to mind and other podcasts like that. And really just branching out from there and reading a lot, audiobooks. And that brought me eventually to the FIRE community. It's not unrelated to the fact that I've been in private wealth management, so there's obviously an interest in personal finance. That world really opened my eyes to a lot of different things, and I realized that that community is doing some really interesting things outside of the quote-unquote traditional personal finance, financial advising community here in the United States. From there, I just started writing, and I really enjoyed it. Right off the bat, I've always been someone that leans a little bit more on the verbal side. Ironically, I'm in an industry, or wasn't an industry, that is all quant and the other side of the equation. But that also, I think, is a strength too. The shorter version, I became interested in these blogs and said, you know what, I think I could do something like this. I think I can write. And really, it was and is still to this day a creative outlet for me where I can explore, experiment, take everything that's bopping around in my head and put it to paper.
So for those of you who don't know what it is, GAR mentioned the FIRE community. So that's the Financial Independence Retire Early community, right?
Correct.
Okay. You mentioned that you had been always on the verbal side, so that sort of dragged you into writing right away. When did you start with the blog? Or did you start writing with the blog, or were you writing before?
I've always done a little bit of journaling, nothing too formal. I've never published anything until the blog. So I guess you could say it was really my first foray into writing, but my background within the financial world, the writing style is very dry and very much devoid of judgment, opinion. It's very factual. It was a process kind of similar to if you are maybe in the scientific community in a lab and you're drafting some type of document like that. It's very cut and dry. And to a certain extent, that informed my writing by simplifying it, removing some of the verbiage that's unnecessary. Then I realized, hey, this is maybe my voice coming out. And I just leaned into that. And as you can see, I haven't been doing this for very long. My 2-year blog-iversary, as they say, is September of this year. So I'm very much in the infancy of this, but in internet time, I'm a dinosaur. And in the FIRE community, I am somewhere in between a dinosaur and a novice. That has positive things associated with it and negative things.
I'm curious, and I think I want to share with the audience. Today, I introduced you as JR and your blog insists in simplicity. This means you've been using this pseudonym, this nickname online, and it's sort of hiding behind the curtain, so we don't really know who's behind. Now we can hear your voice through the phone. I would like to see if you could elaborate a bit on why that pseudonym and why not just expose your identity.
I'm naturally conservative and I naturally have an appreciation for privacy. I'm just a private person to begin with. So that's first and foremost. And I think in the world that we live in, because of a lot of the exogenous forces out there, many people just reveal everything to everybody all the time. And it's not necessarily a good thing. That we could have a whole conversation about that in and of itself. But that's one thing, I think. The second thing, to get back to FIRE, one of the names in that community that basically everybody has heard of is the name Mr. Money Mustache, or MMM. He began writing under that pseudonym, but over time, you know, people figured it out. So I'm not necessarily hiding behind the curtain. I'm just not necessarily revealing everything right up front.
Fair enough. Sounds good. I just wanted to touch on that. I think it's perfectly fine. I think I started writing in English in some way. I've mentioned this in other episodes. That was sort of my way of not revealing everything directly. I was traveling around and I was writing in English instead of writing in Spanish directly. It's not the same, but in some way for me, that was a similar way, not opening up directly with everything that I could, because that in some way detached my writing from where I grew up. And I also agree that it's not necessary to open up and just share everything with no filter. I agree that there is a right for privacy and you can choose up to how much you share, but there are proven downsides to being super, super open with everything. You got to be careful in
sure.
Some way as well.
And it reminds me of Tim Ferriss had a fairly recent podcast about the dangers of fame, essentially. And he was talking exactly about this topic.
Maybe we can get a brief idea for people who don't know your blog. What sort of topics, I mentioned a few ones, but what sort of topics are you covering already that you have some posts on? And which ones would you like to cover in the future because you're inherently interested in?
I intentionally keep it broad across multiple topics. You kind of hit on all of them there. It's permaculture design, simple living, and adventure travel, and to a certain extent, minimalism. But I think that that topic or that phrase is pretty loaded these days.
Agreed.
I avoided that one a little bit. It's obviously influenced by the FIRE community to a certain extent. And one of the topics that I've written about in the past is associated with simple living and Walden, Henry David Thoreau, and getting back into some of the classic literature that I found years ago and how it resonates today. So I've been writing about a little bit of that. One of my earliest posts was about Walden. I recently wrote about John Muir, and my fiance and I, we did a small trip to California where she spent some time about a decade ago in her career. So it was kind of a returning home for her. And we did the Muir Woods and just had a wonderful experience going down the PCH highway. And I wrote about that. Again, I like to keep the topics pretty diverse, and I don't want to necessarily back myself into a corner. I think maybe some blogs have done that in the past. One of the other things that I've tried to incorporate relatively recently is a series of posts, and I'm a goofball. So the topic or the name is Working Out Back with Poppy. It's essentially what I did as a child with my dad, yard work. But this is an evolution of that, and it's incorporating permaculture design and permaculture techniques. So I started with apple tree grafting and grapes and berries. And I will continue in this direction and share with folks some of these techniques and why I think they're important to know and pass on. And that is going to be one of the focuses going forward of the blog. But again, I really don't want to pigeonhole or typecast myself too much. There's a comedian, and I'm going to forget it who said it now, but essentially what he said was, I don't want to be a guy. And what he meant by that is, this might be a very Americanism type of thing, but a lot of people I've heard colloquially, they'll say, oh, I'm a blank guy, meaning that they like that. I find that really weird, because you're just immediately clumping yourself with everybody else that likes that. And it's just another form of identity politics, which is one of the things that is ripping apart our country right now. Totally different conversation.
I always try to, you know, leave topics wide open. I'm always guilty of mixing a bit too much. It's hard to find your identity when you want to be in many different topics. I feel that many people with different interests, they end up narrowing down what they work on. I think that requires a lot of discipline. Like you say, I'm going to write about this in 2016, but 2020 maybe, you have new interests, or you got bored of the initial intention. I think it's good to keep it wide. Keep the title wide open and abstract or non-defined enough to be able to be original again in the future.
Yeah, I agree, but I also disagree. It has its pros and cons. So you can be a generalist or you can be a specialist. And maybe this is a good segue for my parents' art, and specifically my dad. My dad has been painting and drawing classic automobiles for most of his life. I mean, you can't get much more specific than that. He's gotten to a point in his process and his skills. I mean, Malcolm Gladwell, you know, 10,000 hour rule. He is way past that. He is a master at what he does. So I had that model growing up and continue to see it every day. And in the beginning, when I was a young kid, I looked at that and I was like, oh my gosh, I could never be an artist, because I just can't do that. I could never do it like that. So in a way, it dissuaded me from some of the more creative pursuits as a youngster. But now that I'm a very mature, mid-30s person, I'm reconnecting with those things in a very real way. And I think that the changes through technology that have been happening over the years and are changing at an exponential rate, not a linear rate, and are only accelerated by COVID-19, empower creative people like never before. Take yourself, for example. I found your blog and podcast just randomly. That would not have happened in the past. And it's an amazing way to connect with people all over the world. So there's a lot of good stuff happening despite all of the crap in the world right now.
I always think that I have that present daily. The fact that if you're not spending more than 30 minutes or a few hours a day with something, you just have to acknowledge you're not going to get to master it in the short run. But you need to decide whether you want to, you know, keep yourself up with many different things that you want to stay alive in your day to day, or you want to just choose one. That I think that for me, that's super hard. That used to be easier before than now, because hobbies were hobbies. Today, hobbies are something else. And it's hard for me to say, okay, let go of sketching and just focus on writing, or let go of writing and just focus on podcasting, or let go of everything that you're doing and just focus on your day-to-day work. I don't really have an answer. I agree that to get to be so proficient in doing something as your dad has requires a life commitment. But I think the question that we're asking ourselves is there something else that you can also cope with by doing a few more things? I don't really know. I don't really have an answer, but I'm testing it out at least.
I don't have an answer to that either. I concur. I have the exact same struggle. But I wrote about this to a certain extent in a guest post with the Frugal Engineers, which is within the FIRE community. And the title of the post is Designing Your Life. And it was essentially a book review, same title, Designing Your Life. And at this time, I was trying to do a book review, but also do a review of working with a life coach, which is something that I engaged in Q4 of last year for a few months. And it was a wonderful, wonderful experience and really has changed me for the better. But to get back to the point, designing your life, and the struggle of a generalist being kind of splayed out in 17 different directions. One way, I think, to combat some of that anxiety associated with that is to picture these life designs as different paths. And now I'm just regurgitating this guy's book. You can pick them up and put them down at different times. And hey, maybe JR insisting simplicity is pushing hard for right now, but maybe I'll put that down for a little bit and pick up my finance hat and help people with personal finance, or maybe go in a different direction, something more entrepreneurial, and do some type of venture, real estate deal, or who knows. I think that for me is one way that I can combat the internal strife that the generalist elicits in me. I don't necessarily want to be the specialist.
Fair enough. I was just talking this morning to Carmen Chamorro. It's a future guest that we're going to have in the podcast as well. She has a lot of keys on that. There is this definition of multipotentialite that they call it now. There's room in society and in any work team for generalists or for specialists. When you have a team that is formed by both kinds, that really helps move forward, because there's people who are tinkering with different things and don't really focus on one. And then there's other people who can really dive into one and get the job done. I definitely have chosen at this moment to be a specialized generalist, I would say. I try to narrow down the amount of things. You mentioned 17 directions. I'm trying to narrow it down to 1, 2, 3, 4, trying to make them the most similar possible and try to find an equilibrium.
I think I'm trying to do the exact same thing, and I can really appreciate that. Something that I'm also realizing as I'm doing this is the interconnectedness of these different life designs. Maybe rather than saying, oh, it's not A, B, or C, or D, it's actually Z, and it's a combination of all of that. Maybe that's something, I have no idea. But what I do know is one of the things that really changed for me when I started working with the life coach, and this person is just a person, he's good, but he's not the end-all be-all. I think it was more about the partnership of working with a coach and that process. One of the things that we put on the table right off the bat was the concept of integrity and what is integrity. I think he said it to me. He probably is regurgitating this from somebody else, but it's all good. And essentially, the quote or the idea is integrity is having your thoughts and your words and your actions in line. And for whatever reason, that just really like struck home with me. And I realized that in my day-to-day with my finance hat, doing what I was doing, nah, I wasn't in line. So I had to make a change there. And I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled that I did it. But I'm also, just like any other person, it comes with a lot of anxiety and fear of the unknown and all that. But hey, what are we doing here? Let's go for it.
How did it turn out?
I'm working on some amazing things. I'm not ready to reveal them yet.
Sounds good.
But it's all good. As I mentioned in our last conversation over email, I've been in just hyperdrive since I left. And it's great. It's really good because I think in some of your podcasts that I've listened to in the past, and certainly Tim Ferriss, a common interview question is, what's your process? What's your day-to-day look like? And what's your routine? I had a very set routine when I was in the office life. And part of the maybe challenge or good thing, whatever you want to call it, was creating a new routine, one that I've had 100% autonomy to design myself. What does that actually look like? I always hear this question working with clients in the personal finance world or wealth management world. You'll hear a question, and I really want to make this an antiquated question, but maybe this is just in the United States. Essentially, the question is, when you retire, what do you want to do? That's all retirement planning is talking about after this date. And I think some of the allure of the FIRE community just really flips that whole conversation on its head. And another way to ask that exact same question, the exact same question, but completely differently, is to say, if you only could do one thing for the rest of your life, what would that be? I don't have the answer to that. But I really appreciate the flipping of that question. And essentially, the FIRE community, and it did it for me, and I think it does it for a lot of people, is it's not about the financial aspect at all. You really, really need to get past that mentally. It's about how to live your life and what is important to you.
Yeah, and I think that question is obsolete because, well, one of the reasons why it's obsolete is because there's so much more flexibility on your day job today than there was before. I studied architecture, but I'm not an architect. I almost didn't work as an architect. I just specialized in something else. I think that before you would imagine, okay, if I'm a doctor or if I'm a physician or something, I will do that until I can stop doing that. And then I'll just have to find another occupation. But that's basically what you did now, right? You just say, okay, I'm going to not retire early, but I'm just going to quit this job. I'm going to find a new routine. And basically, you could have waited until you retire to craft your new routine in some way. Every time you change, I think you're going to have to redesign how you live or what you commit your time to.
Yeah, I agree with that. One of the pieces of advice that I was given from my dad and struck with me was he said something along the lines of, hey, JR, he didn't say that because that's not my name. hey, blank. Oftentimes your life goes in periods of like 5-7 years cycles, and then there's some type of paradigm shift. And he didn't say it like this, but that was essentially the message. And that struck a chord with me, because I look back on some things in my quote unquote professional career, and I see, okay, this stint here, I was in this mindset, I was learning these skills, these are the things that I was interested in, and then there was some inflection point, and then I changed into this person. And one of the things that I think this crisis that is facing the world right now, and I don't mean to disparage anybody at all with this comment at all, just let me say that disclaimer, having an ability to be flexible and adapt to situations is going to be, already is, paramount to just getting by, surviving. And rigidity, whether it be something tangible or just a cognitive rigidity, is probably not going to be a winning equation for anybody.
Yep, definitely. Let me try to step back quickly, kind of rewind. What is permaculture design for people who don't know about it? And what is financial independence?
I'll give you a few different definitions because it's really hard, but it's really easy. So the first definition of permaculture is it's gardening. That's it. Don't worry about it. Just go garden. Next definition. You take care of the planet. The planet takes care of you. And then there is a surplus that you take care of others. And those are the three ethics of Mollison and Holmgren's brand of permaculture. Those folks are known as the fathers of the movement. They're Australians. From there, we can get into a very, very nuanced, long, drawn-out conversation about what permaculture design is. But those are the really short versions of it. I did a movie review of The Biggest Little Farm. And essentially, this is a couple out in California that they quit their jobs and went onto a farm and tried to do what they called, quote unquote, traditional farming. But their influences and their mentors were people involved with biodynamic agriculture, specifically with wine culture out there in California. And then that has a lot of overlap with permaculture and what the folks in Australia have been thinking about and doing since the 70s.
I found one thing to define it as a long-lasting and sustainable form of agriculture as well.
Yeah, the actual word is a contraction of two words, permanent agriculture. So the goal is, hey, how do we create a system of agriculture that is sustainable? And the antithesis of that is what is riddled across the United States, which is monoculture farms and all of the terrible implications that come with them, from the crap that they put on them with pesticides and herbicides.
Would you call that traditional agriculture?
No, I would call that just the state of farming.
Quick and dirty agriculture.
Yeah. Well, no, just traditional agriculture in the United States is monoculture. So, hey, let's clear all of this and we're putting potatoes. And as far as you can see, it's potatoes.
I see.
That's not good for the land. So what permaculture promotes are what's called plant guilds and working within an ecosystem to create closed system ecosystems.
What would be the main reasons that you think a plant system needs to be designed in a different way?
The soil. It all goes back to the soil and the health of the soil. Over time, monoculture destroys the soil. And when you have lack of nutrients in the soil, then you have crappy food. It's as simple as that. If you have a biodiverse landscape that mimics nature, then you have the most diversity in microorganisms and nutrients in that soil, and your food is going to be great.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's really as simple as that. And it's easier. That was very eye-opening to me when I read Fukuoka, who wrote The One Straw Revolution. His story, I mean, I don't know everything about him, but the cliff notes, he was a scientist, left whatever he was doing and wanted to, in a very Thoreau-esque way, wanted to get back to the land and figure out what was essential. What he realized was everything comes down to hay, straw, hay. And it is a main component of permaculture gardening, utilizing hay or sheet mulching and becoming as lazy as possible as a farmer.
Where would you point people to if they want to learn more about permaculture?
Well, you really want to do the deep dive. It's on the internet. You can find it. It all started with Bill Mollison and literally pamphlets. There's lots of them and you can go find them. From there, I would go on to his protege who is still with us and doing some amazing things right now, David Holmgren. And I'm actually working through one of his seminal works, I should say, Permaculture Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability. But he recently released a tome called Retro Suburbia. And the way that I look at this, it appears that climate change and the adverse effects of climate change are disproportionately felt across the globe. One of the places that is right at the tip of the spear is Australia, whether it be the Great Barrier Reef or problems with the fires or desertification of the land. There's a lot of issues going on down there. And Holmgren and Mollison, they really started with the concept of peak oil. This was a concept that was more of a everyday term for folks in the 70s, not so much nowadays. One of the things that Holmgren has kind of adapted over his career or thought process is changing peak oil to the new reality of the future, which is a low energy economy. And what does that look like? And how do we live within that? Hence Retro Suburbia. And now this is just turning into a commercial for David Holmgren, which I don't mind. But that's where I would start. I would also, if you want the cliff notes or you happen to be addicted to the internet on your phone, go to practicalselfreliance.com and 10thacrefarm.com. Those are two wonderful blogs that talk about suburban permaculture for the latter, and for the former, she's more up in rural New England, and it's more like homesteading and being off the grid, doing things of that nature.
Seems like something that even the people who are exploiting the mono-agriculture field would be benefited from in the long term, right? Because they're basically, as you're saying, they're destroying the soil.
It's already happening.
Destroyed, or that they're actually doing permaculture for their own good?
No, that has been happening for decades, but permaculture design and the concept of regenerative agriculture is taking hold and exploding.
I see.
I think and I hope.
Okay.
It's not just some quote unquote hippies that want to change the world. It's backed by science.
How would you define financial independence?
Financial independence is defined by not depending on a W-2 income to sustain your expenses.
Can you elaborate on that for non-Americans to know what a W-2 is? I happen to know because I was living there, but...
Your job, your jobby, where you go to work. In the United States, you'll get a W-2 form by the IRS that will help you do your taxes. If you're an independent contractor or something like that, maybe you're getting a 1099 or different tax form. So So the W-2 is just essentially you work for someone else. So the FIRE community is defined by this inflection point where you have built a bucket of money that from a strictly math perspective, which has changed quite dramatically in recent months, by the way, based on a few well-documented financial studies, essentially for people that actually want to find this, the Trinity study is what it's called, and the 4% rule. Based on these studies, you got a pot of money that kicks off enough income on an annual basis or monthly basis to cover your cost of living, your expenses. In all intents and purposes, if you can do that, you are retired. Wouldn't you agree? Rhetorical question. That is essentially the definition of FIRE. Maybe this is a good segue for all of the bad things about the community and why I don't necessarily want to associate myself with it.
Before we dig into criticism or what are the downsides of the community and what people are trying to benefit from that shouldn't be like that, I would ask you first, do you think you follow any practices that would include you in this financial independence attempt?
100%. I was doing them before, and then I found FIRE and it poured gasoline on everything.
Let's hear more.
It's as simple as that. I have been within the world of personal finance, financial advising, wealth management, portfolio management for my whole career. And what's funny or not funny, let's rewind, it's not funny at all. Many of the folks in that community have very, very little knowledge of how to actually save money and how to actually be fiscally responsible. To a certain extent, maybe not everybody, especially not the FIRE community, but some people, myself included, in their early 20s, they don't necessarily have a focus on saving a high percentage of their income. I certainly didn't. I was focused on some other things. For a lot of people in the United States, they get the message too late. And the FIRE community, again, does a very good job of just getting the math right and understanding the power of compound interest, compound returns over time. Time value of money and what putting away a high percentage of your income early on can do for you decades later.
I know that that might be specific for each person, of course, but what would be a rule of thumb? Like, how much would you say makes sense to save as soon as you start working from every monthly paycheck?
Okay, so this is where I might diverge a little bit, and this is where I might get a little extreme. Rule of thumb for the FIRE community is if you are trying to do this, you really should be shooting for 50%, which is a big number. If you look at the hard statistics, they vary across different countries and demographics. In the United States, our savings rate is disgusting. It's very, very low. Here in the United States, typically, you know, you'll have a 401k if working for a larger employer or a mid-sized employer, and you'll work at the HR department to set that up. And essentially, you'll have zero to very little help and guidance in what you're actually supposed to be doing within that. You might be lucky enough to have one person come in once a year who's basically a salesperson to give you financial education. It's a sad reality of our system. So the reason why I say that is most people, when they save for their 401k, they depend on the people around them, their coworkers or their older sibling or something. And they'll say, hey, how much do I put in my 401k? And the typical response will be anywhere between 5 and 15%. Okay, that's fine. Just look at the math though. Look at the math. How long do you want to be in that cube? That is really the question. And for a lot of people in the United States, keeping up with the Joneses is some type of mental sickness, really is. buy a Tesla. I have nothing against Tesla. You don't have to buy a Tesla.
Yeah, it's time, right? How much time you need to work to get a Tesla?
Yes, exactly. I mentioned Mr. Money Mustache is one of the fathers of this movement, but really what his math is based on a book called Your Money or Your Life by Vicky Robin, which is popular within the personal finance community. It uses the word or phrase life energy instead of money. So you hit the nail on the head. You're trading your time for money.
And also you're trading other things, right? Sometimes experiences. You said adventure travel. A Tesla might buy you many flights and many accommodation fees and many things like that.
I was just going to say that's also a component of the FIRE community too. So one of the things that many of the FIRE folks talk about and advocate for is utilizing what used to be called credit card churning, but I don't like that phrase. I think it would just be more helpful for everybody if people just called it responsible use of credit cards.
Do you have any specific frugal practices on your day-to-day or monthly that you do that help you save money?
Yeah. Oh my God. Gazillions. They're all stupid, but that's the thing is with anything, it's gamification. If you use cash, which less and less people do, especially in post-COVID, we might be a cashless society, but again, that's a totally different conversation. Research suggests that if you use a credit card, you are more inclined to make impulsive purchases. If you have actual dollars in your hand, it's harder to part with them. It's also harder to part with them if they are larger denominations. So one thing that you can do is just carry some cash and really think about it and have them in larger denomination. And that alone will maybe make you a little bit more hesitant, maybe make you a little bit more mindful of those purchases that you're making. And that could lead hand in hand with another stupid little thing, which is not stupid, but you have a change jar or a little thing, whatever. Every time that you go and spend that cash, say it's a $20 bill, and just like some of the banks and fintech companies, they'll do this electronically, automatically with your credit card or debit card. You take that cash and whatever change you have, you put it in your jar and you forget about it. Then you come back to it like a year later. All of a sudden, now you got some money. Do something with that. Put it somewhere. Buy something that you've been thinking about for a while. Didn't buy it impulsively because you've had this little bucket over here building for the last 12 months so you could buy it in a responsible way.
When you were mentioning the cash example, I just got another little thing that I do. I think it can become a bit obsessive in some way, but I think in 2011, so it's like already 9 years, I got used to writing down every single purchase I do. Like,
yeah.
Period. I write down on a plain text note the day I spent it, how much I spent it, and what it was in. It doesn't change anything, but it changes everything because it makes you aware of when you're spending. You said you swipe your credit card 3, 4, 5 times one day. You don't really notice that much, even though now phone apps give you a lot of feedback so you can see the numbers and all those things.
Right.
But again, if you do a cash purchase or if you lend money to someone or if you actually pay a debt with cash or do things like that, those are things that maybe spread across bank accounts and cash transactions and things like that, and you lose track actually of how much you're spending. So having one place where every single spend goes, it's helping me. One day you come back home, you bought a few things, and you say, wow, $200. What did I actually spend it on?
Right.
Things like that. It just lets me revisit, and I think in some way that changes your mind long-term because you start being more mindful about your spending habits.
I agree, but allow me to play devil's advocate. So one of the earlier FIRE leaders, let's say, that's been around for quite a while is a guy named Brandon, and he writes at the Mad Scientist. He's been financially independent for years, and a really good post, I mean, I think this is going back like years now, But essentially, the post was how he felt when he, quote unquote, hit his number, his financial independence number. He didn't feel anything, is the answer. You don't change. You're not a different person. It means absolutely nothing. So the reason why I'm saying this is I agree. Yeah, it can be very, very constructive to write down every single purchase that you ever make. But you can also become a psychopath doing that. And I think a lot of people, not a lot, but I'm saying that there is potential for people go in a direction with this that is not healthy. And what, for me, what works is rather than focusing on every dime that's in and out, every penny that's in and out, it's more about creating the habits and creating the day-to-day that will just get me to that place in the same way. And just to finish this point, I think it's important too, because the same person, he did a thought experiment. And 1 year after he achieved financial independence, the year leading into this, and I might be screwing up the details, but the year leading into this, he was obviously extremely fiscally conservative, probably to the point of unhealthy. And when he hit his number or a year later, again, the details don't matter, he decided to do the opposite and not track anything for a year and just blow it out, spend whenever he wanted to spend. Did the accounting at the end of the year, and he spent $5,000 more than he did the previous year. Why? Because of the habits and the inculcated behavior. That's what I'm trying to develop in myself and others, rather than, hey, let's talk about the 10 best ways to blah, blah, blah.
Another thing that you mentioned, how do you define that number usually?
That's a really good question. That number is defined by math. And that number is defined or derived by your spend, which is your cost of living. So everything comes back to your cost of living. So it's not about how much money you make, it's about how much money you spend. Do you want to be a millionaire or do you want to spend $1 million?
In the past, when I started accounting with my, you know, how much I'm spending, actually the math that I haven't yet done, I just have this tool that will tell me how much I'm spending every month or whatever, right?
Yeah.
From that information. But the interesting detail that I want to see is over time, as I've moved from living, so I lived in the US, then in Australia, then in London, then in the US, then in Spain. And I have this log from all those times. And I want to see like how much did I spend and what did I spend it on for in each of these times. At least I can get, I think that would be a really good, and that might be the main reason why I'm doing this more than frugality.
Right.
Just to be able to account later, like how much to keep up with this lifestyle that I had when I was living in the US or to keep up with this lifestyle that I'm having here in Spain, how much money do I actually need? And I think it all comes to that, exactly to what you said. Do you want to be a millionaire? Or do you want to spend $1 million?
Right.
What do you want to buy?
Right.
You can, you know, if you don't want to spend anything any month, any year, maybe you already hit your number, right? If you don't need money, you already hit that number.
Right. There is a cautionary tale to be told here. The 4% rule is assuming that you can generate this level of income in perpetuity to cover your expenses, i.e. you never run out of money. Is that the goal? Or you can't take it with you? Is the goal to spend it all before you die? That's a philosophical question that people have to answer for themselves. So in you put it into a wealth management context and you're talking about estate planning, there are some people that say to themselves, hey, I'm going to enjoy my retirement and I want to spend every single dollar. And if I die with zero in the bank account, that means I did it perfectly. There are other people that want to leave a legacy, whether it be to children, grandchildren, foundation, or educational institution, and their goal is to leave X when they die. That's great too. Those are totally different scenarios. So a cautionary tale, a real life cautionary tale, I read this story about a janitor for one of the local universities here in New England. People knew that he dabbled in stocks over the years, but the guy was just, you know, like depression era type of demeanor. He ate Triscuits for lunch and a piece of bread and toast as a snack. That was his deal. Sure enough, the guy dies years later. He's worth like $3 point something million in stocks. And he didn't have any offspring, and he basically donated his entire net worth to the educational institution. And when you do that, I'm not sure with this particular institution, but I believe you can direct it towards something very specific, or you can just say, you know, best use. And sure enough, they took his decades worth of work and invested in a scoreboard for the football team. So the reason why I'm saying this is, you know, do you want to slave away for half a century and build up this huge nest egg so that someone else can squander it or do something stupid with it? Maybe not, but do you also want to blow it out and leave nothing for someone else or for other folks? I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I think those are individual decisions.
Fair enough. No, I think I've learned a lot. I think that's, you know, things to keep in mind. It's really hard. You never know. Like, it's a chicken and egg problem, right? Like, you spend money, and then if you don't spend it, you have more. But why do you want to have more if you cannot spend it? So it's a bit hard. How would you, so are you part, or have you engaged with any online communities of the FIRE community? And also, you mentioned before, everything's not bright, everything's not positive. So what would be your criticism, or what things can go wrong online, or what are the bad parts of the FIRE community?
Yeah, I wrote about this pretty recently. I think my biggest issue with the community is the conflicts of interest and the affiliate kickbacks that drive a lot of the revenue behind some of these blogs. Simply put, if you are on the internet and you're telling people, hey, go out and use this blank, this is the greatest blank ever, it helps me, it's going to help you, use this blank, here's a link. Oh, by the way, I'm going to get a little commission on that, little kickback if you click on that link. It's okay, because I told you and I disclose it's an affiliate link. So it's all good. That's not all good. That is a direct conflict of interest. And if you're out there on the internet giving financial advice with a direct conflict of interest, that's a huge problem for me. So I try to avoid that as much as possible. I have explored, and we talked about this a little bit before, about monetization of the website. And frankly, the more that I think about it, the less I want to go down any type of path of monetization. But at the same time, there are expenses associated with running a blog, as you know. So I don't have the answer to that, but it is very frustrating for me to see a blog that comes up that it's just, oof. I mean, you can just blur your eyes and you can tell that the entire point is just clickbait to get somebody to click on something and sign up for something. The revenue incentives with a lot of the community is, I think, no longer in line with the original intent, which was some of the really early ones, and I'm not going to rattle them off. There's a lot, but the one that everybody kind of knows of is Mr. Money Mustache. So essentially, him and others that followed him, and myself included to a certain extent, are just giving advice and saying, these are the things that work for me, these are the things that I'm exploring, and oh, by the way, Mr. Money Mustache is giving financial advice, but he's really talking about sustainability. I'm doing the exact inverse of that. There is a whole wave of FIRE bloggers after this, myself included, and people after me, that are just getting right to the SEO component and trying to drive traffic to buttons to monetize so that they can make money. And I mean, I don't necessarily blame anybody for wanting to make money, but it's just, it's muddied the water so much and watered it down that most of the stuff that's out there is just unreadable.
Yeah, this reminds me, so anyone who knows about the FIRE communities or want to reach financial independence, they have a blog and they're writing about it. They're using these techniques that might be, you know, they might be trying to use the blog itself to monetize, to, you know, have some sort of passive income and then reach their goal of financial independence. I'm just making this up, right? But that makes total sense to me, because when I read books, for instance, on people who are talking about productivity and grit and being able to commit to your goals and things like that, you start off from the point of, this person has published a book. So if this person has published a book and it got to my hands, there is already a really low percentage of people who can do that because of their commitment, because of how they manage to get it published, because of the content that they're publishing to get it to me. So it's so well known that it gets to me. There's always an implicit bias on these things, that how you reach to a point of seeing that and where you learn from it.
That makes perfect sense to me. And it reminds me of a situation where I'm not going to blow this person up, but I stumbled upon one of these blogs, and this person did have a book, and it was essentially, look at me, I'm financially independent, is the book. And I just read like the little blurb, and it said something along the lines of, well, I've been saving money hard for 2 years and now I'm financially independent and here's my book. Wait, what? The time does not make sense. So you clearly wrote the book before you were funny, or some combination. I mean, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. But what I'm saying is, it just muddies the water, and it is really gotten away from some of the original ones. And I mean, I didn't even say, you know, Mr. Money Mustache, and I believe him. I believe people for their word until they prove otherwise. He says that he still maintains a cost of living of $27,000 a year. His blog alone generates, at this point, it might be $500,000, but the last time I heard the number, it was like $300,000 a year. There was one that was maybe a little bit lesser known before Mr. Money Mustache, called Early Retirement Extreme. And this person essentially lived in a van. And I mean, it's extreme. And his burn rate was like 13 grand a year. So what do you do with that? Yeah. I mean, sure. Do you want to have that lifestyle? Maybe, you know, maybe that is it. And to a certain extent, I'm obviously attracted to the concept of simple living and to a stoic aesthetic and something that is boiled down to the really fundamental things in life that matter. And you don't necessarily need cars and mansions and consumerism to do any of those things.
Okay, so moving out a bit from the financial independence topic, you mentioned before your dad being specialized, being making art for 50 years or so, and specializing in one thing, so putting a lot onto his art.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say are the main struggles on trying to make art and live on what you produce?
Well, first, because I want to have a healthy relationship with my family, I need to say that my dad and my mom are both artists, and they are both incredibly talented artists. To answer your question, I saw firsthand the struggles of trying to make a living as an artist. So my parents, they met here in Boston at Mass Art years ago, and they have spent the majority of their life, they've had traditional jobs over the years. My mom primarily as an art teacher, and my dad, this starts to make more sense for me and my interest in permaculture. My dad was a forest ranger for about 30 years. So he went into the woods by day and came home and painted by night. Pretty cool life, but not one that necessarily is highly lucrative. So to get to your question, I think the biggest struggle for them, especially my dad, I think having shows and being in front of people and constantly hearing how wonderful your artwork is, but then not really seeing the success from a monetary standpoint. And I mean, that's defined my parents' career, and that probably, unfortunately, defines the artistic career of a lot of artists. Van Gogh comes to mind as the quintessential example, but sometimes you can be incredibly talented as a creative, but just absolutely suck at marketing and business, or you just have no interest in it, or you see it as a sellout, which I think is pertinent in my dad's situation, especially. We had contemplated maybe putting some of his stuff on one of the POD platforms, print on demand. There's many of them nowadays, but essentially you upload some stuff and people can go up there. They can print off a painting there's a gazillion out there and they're all tailored to different niches, whether you be a doodler and you're just making like little maybe logos or something like that, or t-shirt designs, mug designs. You know, there's a website for that. If you're more of classically trained fine artists, there's a market for that and a platform for that. But once you get to a level, I think because my dad's not there, obviously, but I think once you get to a level of notoriety and just skill, people will find you, and a curator from some type of gallery will eventually find you. And frankly, it's a matter of time for my dad. And what my struggle has been really is I'm too close to it. And I've seen the lack of success over the years and the way that it makes him feel about his own artwork. And it causes me some pain there because I just want to see him get recognition. And it's not about the money at all. But then you really start to think deeply on that, and do you want the recognition? Do you want, I don't know, is it more about just the process of it, that the meaning? I'm not sure, but I think what has worked for my parents is when I was a little kid, so probably late 80s into the 90s, my parents were actively trying to go down to Manhattan and get into, you know, the big, big galleries. And I think that experience was really, really hard for them because they just got kicked around a little bit and maybe, you know, didn't treat them as they wanted to be treated, as nice folks from rural Massachusetts. I have no idea. I was too young to really know the deal there. But what I do know is my dad, especially afterwards, when I was more of a teenager, high school, college, he would have sporadic shows, but they would be much more localized in Massachusetts and really just extended friends, family, just smaller things. And again, everybody would say, oh my goodness, your stuff is so good. This is so great. And nothing sells. So that is a huge struggle for an artist to constantly be told how good you are and then not be able to eat. That is tough. It's really tough.
Yeah, I can completely relate to that. So my mom is also an artist, and I also personally draw and do sketches. And I think that the summary of what you're saying, which I relate completely to, is that praise doesn't equal money. Mm-hmm. And there needs to be, I don't know, there needs to be a system, right? Well, not a system, but I feel that many times it seems that if that praise goes along with sales, as you mentioned, maybe that gives you some ease or peace of mind. If you need the money, right? If you need the money to eat, then that's necessary. It's a necessity. You do need it. But sometimes my mom, for instance, is a dentist, apart from that. So that art has always been her side thing, her hobby or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really know. I feel the same that when you said before, when you hit that number, that amount that you said that you have financial independence, you don't feel anything. I don't think selling, so the actual monetary transaction, gives you a lot of fulfillment either way.
Yeah.
Right? It lets you eat, definitely. But I don't know how much fulfillment it gives you as a person, as an artist. And I'm still to figure it out. I don't really know. Sometimes it's really hard. I mean, I know when you become so good that you feel things should sell, I don't really know how to account with that. It seems like, for instance, if you give praise to a movie or you criticize it, at least you've paid for it before watching. But when you see art, you can enjoy it. But you say, maybe I don't really have the need to acquire it.
One thing that's buried in here is, I mean, essentially now we're talking a branch of philosophy, aesthetics. You know, what is art? What is beautiful and all that? I think, I don't know, but I think that time works in favor of the quote-unquote true artist. If you're producing something that is good, that stands by itself in its own right, you might not get recognized for it immediately. And again, the recognition might not be the goal, the whatever. But over time, just like anything that is amazing and beautiful and worthy, people will find it. People will appreciate it. And I look at my dad's stuff, especially, and my mom's stuff, as just undiscovered gems. And it's like this little secret that I know about and nobody else. And part of me wants to steal a throw quote to go scream on the mountaintops and tell everybody about it. But over the years, I've struggled with this. Should I be that person? Should I be advocating like a crazy man to sell my dad's art? Or should it just happen naturally? Or should he be the one that drives that? Or should it be maybe force? You know, if you look back through time, a lot of the greatest artists out there, they have some type of art critic or some type of group of some kind that really promotes and brings their art into a greater consciousness. There's a lot of mixed emotions with it, and just like art itself, it's filled with emotion. So for me to give a real cut and dry answer to anything about my dad's and my mom's art is just, it's just so hard to do.
It's always unclear whose responsibility it is to quote unquote market what you're doing, right? Many times you say, yeah, if it doesn't spread with word of mouth, then it's not good. But I think there needs to be somebody who actively, you know, you need to at least post it online, take it to a gallery, do an exhibit, or some people might be responsible for spreading your idea if they end up sharing it in their communities or if it's your podcast or your book or whatever. So I don't know. I personally am trying to figure it out as well. Like, I don't really know how to account with what's working and what's not working and what's spreading or not and the best ways to do it or whose responsibility it is.
But even that concept, is that the goal? I don't know. I really don't know. And I don't know if my parents, of course, there is a certain, I think for any artist, they want to have a worth associated with their product. And because of the way that our society is set up and our brains work, we associate worth with a monetary value. So that, I don't think that's ever going to go away, but I think for my dad, at least, one of the things that he has done way better than many people do is really just take all that stuff and just not even have it in his head. And instead, just paint and draw like a madman. And he's been doing that for decades. So where does it go? I have no idea, but up until this point, he's a prolific artist with tons of work that nobody knows about. It's awesome.
It is. We'll find an answer in the future. So let's now move into the getting simple section to learn a bit more about your daily life and habits.
Sure.
You mentioned before that after quitting your job, you have to redesign your new routine. Can you talk a bit about how that's going and what your current new routine is looking like or not looking like?
Yeah. I am happy to talk about this because I'm trying to actively make this my focus. I left my job and post COVID, my fiance has been working at home and we live in a 600 square foot condo in Somerville. So it can be tight. This has worked for us and for me in particular has just been to really think about my schedule now that I have 100% flexibility in designing that schedule. My fiance and I are very complementary in the fact that I am a very much a morning person and she is not. So I wake up crazy early and I get a lot of stuff done right off the bat. And it starts with the foam roller and some yoga stuff. And then it gets right into writing. And that's either in the journal or putting together a new blog post. I'm trying to maintain a once per week schedule, but it shifts here and there depending on what's going on in life and how in-depth the topic is. And really what I'm trying to do with this blog is not write little fluffy clickbait stuff. So each post I'm hoping is very thoughtful and long form and meaningful for people. Afternoon or lunch is food and exercise. Recently, it's been a lot of biking and running. And then afternoon, more creative time, reading, maybe note-taking, or just on the blower, talking to people, exploring some entrepreneurial stuff and some more traditional job opportunities too. And evening, occasional Netflix. I hate television, but I love film. So I will get sucked in to some certain things, but that's pretty much it. Pretty simple life.
It is. Do you do any meditation?
Yes, but I suck at it, like everybody.
Yeah, that's how it's meant to be.
When I was really intense with podcasts, not so much anymore, but I found Dan Harris in 10% Happier, his journey as a novice into meditation. And it's a good read. It's a very, very readable book. It's very relatable too. He has basically taken this as his main thing, left being a journalist and does this now full time, which is pretty cool. I've listened to a lot about meditation, and now this is going to start to annoy people a lot. So I just mentioned Dan Harris. So Sam Harris of the Waking Up podcast. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
I am, yeah. Making sense.
He has a background in neuroscience and very much is a believer and a practicer of meditation. He's got his own app and whole business and doing all that stuff there. I haven't really delved much into that, but I can appreciate guided meditation and some of the apps like Calm that are coming out that can help people get to whatever place they need to get. For me, though, is really more focused on what I call man yoga. So it's more just like some yoga poses, some breathing exercises, and foam roller, and some light meditation. But I'm not going to try to sit there for 30 minutes. I'm trying to go for 5-10 minutes at this point. And I do use a mantra to a certain extent. I'm not going to tell you because it's mine. You can't take it. I'm just kidding. But some people use a mantra and it works for them. I would concur. It works for me. So that's my experimentation into meditation. It's clunky, it's novice and amateurish, but that's who I am, I guess.
Thanks for sharing. I've been also trying to practice for years now, but I still feel like a beginner. So let's keep trying. I'm up to the like 10 to 20 minutes a day threshold right now. I think anything that gets your mind empty for a bit of your time and you're aware of it and yeah, it's in purpose, it's not a mindless thing, is super helpful. One thing I wanted to ask you, how do you come across Getting Simple? Because I know you shoot me an email and that's how we started the conversation.
Part of building insisting simplicity, at least for me, and I don't know if this is the same thing for you, for other bloggers, but If you decide to start a blog, you inevitably will start learning SEO and keyword research and essentially how the internet actually works. You might not like what you find, but what you do find is keywords drive everything. And so I started just looking at the keyword simple and simplicity, and I found you. And you're right. I sent you an email, and I forget what exactly what I said, but I think I said something along the lines of, we may be barking up the same tree or something like that.
Yeah, probably.
So just the amazing ability to connect with totally random people because of the internet and technology, you know, there are huge positives. That's how I found you at this time. And it goes back to some of the criticisms of FIRE and monetization of blogs is if you really strip down some of these, not some of them, many of them, if you strip down internet pages, it's all about keywords and it's all about marketing and driving revenue and clicks and eyeballs to certain things. And is that what I want to do?
What's next for you? Can you unveil? I know you said before that some parts are secret, but is there anything that you can unveil?
I've been saying this every Monday for the last 3 weeks, I think. This week is going to be really important. And I'm going to really figure out what's going on next. I haven't been wrong. Each week has been very important to me personally in the last few weeks in terms of just making incredible connections. And as we're working through this virus, our economy is opening at different paces. So in certain respects, it's debilitating. But in other respects, it gives a little bit of space, a little bit of mental space for me in particular. And I feel deep gratitude for the privilege to be in this position. But it's something that I built with a margin of safety, and that goes back to the FIRE stuff. And that's a totally different conversation. To answer your question, which I am doing a horrible job of, is I don't know. I'm pursuing multiple life designs simultaneously, and I am pretty close, I believe, to having that next step, whatever it may be, more defined in the next couple few weeks. I still don't know exactly what that's going to look like. I've got a pretty good idea and I'm really excited about it, but I want to make sure that whatever I do this next step, I can do it and I'm not so stretched that it puts too much strain on my family that I want to build with my fiance soon and the rest of my family, but also something that is worthy of doing. And what I was doing before was not worthy of anything. It made some money and stuff, but it wasn't helping anything, really. So the next thing that I'm going to do is going to be something that is going to have a lot more meaning and purpose.
That sounds great. How can people find you online?
The website, Insisting Simplicity. I have a tortured relationship with technology, like I think a lot of people do, but I am on Instagram and begrudgingly on Twitter.
I'm excited to see what you release next. Okay, let's do a quick round of fast questions. I'll do a few and then we can wrap up. How would you define success?
Being comfortable in your own shoes.
What are some of your role models?
Oh my gosh. Real characters in books, alive or dead.
Oh, you pick anything.
My parents, of course. I I'm very close with my parents and I love them very much. We talk very often and they are constant role models for me. Tim Ferriss, Sam Harris have been pretty influential in recent years, I would say. Maybe going back a little bit further, Henry David Thoreau, Walt Whitman, Emerson. Yeah. I got stuck in that for a little while and that was a good place to be. And that, I think, influences some of my writing, too, and the New England feel.
What would be some book recommendations you can point us to?
I think that the personal finance books that have been most influential for me have been Your Money or Your Life, Millionaire Next Door, Those are the two, I think, that really jump off the page, but that's not really anything too interesting. A lot of people will point to those in the personal finance world. For permaculture design, I mentioned some earlier. I would really highly recommend people starting with Bill Mollison and then moving on to David Holmgren, and then a gentleman named Sepp Holzer, Joel Salatin too. Those are some good names to give an introduction to permaculture design. And then for years, I just read fiction. Don't do that. But read the classics. I always come back to Player Piano by Kurt Vonnegut. I'm not going to say anything about it. Just read it.
Well, thanks for those pointers. Is there a recent purchase of $100 or less that had a positive impact on your life?
Yes. The Brimfield Fair last summer. And it's this sprawling open marketplace for antiques and furniture and crafts and everything. And I found a 50-year-old Boone gouge, a metal hand tool. And I've been using that quite a bit in my silly little woodworking projects. And it brings me great joy.
Is there anything that's helped you write better?
After I found your podcast, I listened to some of your stuff and some of the tips and your process. And that made me rethink some things at other bloggers and seeing different styles and what works. Not from a traffic standpoint, but which writers do I enjoy and being influenced by that to a certain extent. I think that's been very helpful. And then just like anything, just writing. Anybody can go on the blog. I've purposely tried to not go back and massively edit some of the original posts. They're horrifyingly bad. I hope that my style and my voice has become a little bit better over the short period that I've been writing. And I want to continue to improve, but it's just like anything else. You just keep on chopping wood and you're going to get better.
Well, first of all, that's humbling to hear that in some way listening to previous episodes help you out with rethinking your process or improving it in any way. But I think what you just touched on, like reading your past posts, like from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago and realizing the things that could be better, right? What you would then do today that's different, at least for me as a native Spanish speaker, it's great. It's like, yeah, I mean, I did that. It's not great. But the fact that I can recognize today how I could fix it or how I would do it better, that lets me visualize my improvement in some way, I hope. And also, yeah, I guess reading a lot has helped me a lot. Like reading more nonfiction mainly books, because yep. I'm not reading that much fiction lately. And also, as you said, finding authors that you like the tone. I lately enjoyed a lot John Maeda's book. He's an artist, designer, technologist, businessman, and from MIT. And the tone, how he plays with a book that is funny at the same time that is rigorous in research and has pragmatic examples, is really revealing. And for instance, I really like the way that Seth Godin takes writing. Like as you said before, right, he has, I would never, if you just don't see where posts are coming from, it would be really hard for me to see that those are marketing posts, that he's talking about marketing and business and anything. He talks about everything. He talks about economy, technology, trust, convenience, anything that you can relate to a human, right? And I think that's part of his success, that he found that even though the common thread, at least he says so, is marketing, right? He touches upon daily topics that are current and that anyone that reads the blog can relate to in any aspect of their lives, right?
Yeah, he's a beast.
Yeah, he's a beast. And publishing one, as you said before, like publishing one post a day, right? Over that amounts to many thousands of hours of writing over the course of years.
That's also something that's incredibly difficult to make that time commitment and to plug in and say, all right, I'm gonna not only write every day, but I'm gonna post something every day.
That's super hard.
And there are many people that do that poorly And you see the post, and it's like three paragraphs that are not worth looking at. And his stuff is just so tight and well crafted.
Yeah. Well, last thing I usually do on these interviews is there anything that you want to ask, any topic you want to raise, or anything you want to ask me, or any last thing that you want to say?
I don't have any deep message for humanity. I would just say that, especially right now, let's just give everybody the benefit of the doubt.
Well, I want to do a quick recap. So as you mentioned before, JR and myself met over the internet. So he happened to find me. So we spent months exchanging emails, a couple online calls, and we were actually expecting to record this in person. That's the way I like to roll in some way. You know, I have my gear, I bring it, and then I can control the environment in some way. This time, this is the second interview that we record and Getting Simple that is remote. In this case, we're using my microphone here, his cell phone, and just an internet connection to record his voice on my recorder. I hope that the quality was good enough, because it's, you know, this for me is one of the things that I need to try to do more often. It's like, I would have postponed this for months if I was hoping to get there in person. And at some point, you know, you need to trade in quality for the actual content, right? I think our conversation was pretty good. I hope it sounds okay so people can enjoy it. And I just wanted to thank you a lot, JR. So I would like to thank you for the commitment you've put to this and the message that you got through today. I've learned a lot. I hope our listeners have as well. Thanks for your time. I would say, hopefully we can record something else in the near future. We'll keep the conversation going. And anyone that has any comments, at least feel free to reach me on Twitter. I'm at NonoESP. And let me know what you think. Let me know if you like this, if there's any topics that we've covered today that you think that we should talk more about on the podcast, or you would like me to cover more in the podcast. And if you also enjoyed the conversation with JR, we can probably call him more often or have him on the show in the future talking in more depth about some of his work.
That sounds great.
Yeah. So again, thank you for joining today.
Thank you, Nono. This was really fun.
All right. So this was one more episode of the Getting Simple podcast with JR from Insisting Simplicity. You can check out his blog at insistingsimplicity.com. And I just want to thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time. If you enjoyed the show, remember that you can find a detailed list of episode notes, transcripts, and previous episodes at gettingsimple.com. I'm also starting to upload learning videos to YouTube to teach how I do things, and we'll start live streaming in the near future, covering topics from computational design and creative coding to design automation, machine learning, workflow optimization, or even how I make this podcast. You can find these videos if you go to gettingsimple.com/YouTube and look for my learning playlist.